in the world, in the software and the technology we've created in AI, it's much more important to understand the problem and the outcome that we're trying to drive than it is to have all the bodies kind of, you know, touching data and doing all these kind of, you know, sort of basic things. So the software does all that. And in our world, so therefore you're the main person is, or people, is always the one who says, okay, let me describe the problem really clearly, like hyper clearly.
Welcome back to Building the Base. Lauren Badula and Hondo Gertz here with today's guest, Paul Breitenbach. Paul has an incredible story that we're digging into today, including as one of the founders of Priceline. I know I'm a big user of Priceline, and now founder of a company called R4, which is focused on AI, doing some work primarily on the commercial side, but also for the Department of Defense story. So Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here with you.
So, Paul, once again, we really enjoy this podcast because we get such a diverse set of guests here with all sorts of interesting stories. What's your story? How does a guy growing up in New Jersey wind up having the career you have and now getting in the national security community?
Yeah, it's great. The I grew up in New Jersey. I was a musician as a kid.
Cool.
And I kind of thought I was, when I got to school music originally, I realized after a couple of weeks, okay, I really don't want to do this. I'm really good at it. I was the youngest union member, Local 399, basically the middle of New Jersey. And so I thought it was going to be my career. And then, so I get up, show up to my advisor when I show up at school. So I don't want to be in music. You know, how I got into Cornell was really because I was a phenomenal musician, right? So when they're trying to rebuild the wind ensemble, they're like, oh, this is pretty cool. This, I mean, this is the director of the wind ensemble says, how do I tell you I want somebody? Because I was not the guy to get into, you know, a top school like that. But so I was very lucky. But so my advisor was the chairman of the sociology department. And since I had no clue what I wanted to do, he says, oh, this is perfect. Social 101, Social 102, just signed up for it because he wanted to fill up his incredibly, you know, empty department with new kids, right? And so I said, I'm really interested in this computer thing. Like, you know, whatever. So he gets the big book out, puts his glasses on, he's flipping through, and he says, Computer Science 100, go take that. So I knew nothing about it. And of course, I said, I want to go do this. My story, so I took the, you know, Computer Science 100, failed the first prelim, and the professor said, you know, go try, oh my God, I've never gotten an F, you know. And then he said, stick with the class. I'm like, okay, so I took the second prelim, failed it worse than the first prelim. And I got a guy, said, I got to withdraw from this class. I know it's going to be a W, but I need your permission now. It's so bad. And he said, okay, fine, I'll let you withdraw. The guy did me such a huge favor. He says, I'll let you withdraw on one condition. Fine, what's the condition? You have to come to class every single day because you're my best student. All the other monkeys just repeat what I tell them. I actually go home and think about what you say. And I, of course, like as a young kid, I'm like, then why are you failing me, right? How can I fail something that you think I'm so good at? So it's just kind of a precursor to the, you know, my career as a tech guy. So I'm a tech entrepreneur. I was very lucky, you know, to find my way to a great team with Jay Walker and the other early Priceline crew. And you guys know this, it takes a team to win, right? Culture, yeah, we had a great strategy, but culture eats strategy for lunch. We had an amazing group, and there's not much to debate about. It's just been a runaway home run 25 years later. I just feel like we're lucky. We're living in this world of the internet era. That was awesome. This world with AI, you know, a long time ago, we said to ourselves, geez, we're making all this money. We're not really doing anything. Remember back then with the internet, computers are running and this thing is making all this money, this revenue, billions of dollars. And what about all the other organizations that were left behind in this data math thing, right? Because, you know, one of the big secrets behind Priceline, Shatner was cool and whatnot, but the end of the day was data and math. And, being able to automate that. So we're just really lucky. So about 10, 12 years ago, we second round, try to get this AI thing to work, and it's really going incredibly well. But that's kind of my story. Tech entrepreneur for a long time, it has led us into defense, as we'll get to in a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm. And 10 to 12 years ago, to have that vision around artificial intelligence, you can't go 30 minutes in this town without hearing AI. What was it about AI that caught your attention as a founder, a tech entrepreneur? How did you know this was going to be the next big thing?
So we were doing it before they called it AI, if I'm being honest, right? Like this whole concept of using data and math in real time. And the we had a very heretical view, and we built into R4 something that people still have a hard time getting their heads around is, you know, people think of AI and it's just incredible amounts of bodies and data scientists doing things manually, right? Mm-hmm. We built it with a goal in mind of the customer needs zero data scientists. And that's a mic drop moment, right? It's what are you talking about? How can it be possibly true? But we knew this was going to be such a complicated thing. The concept that if companies don't know how to build software, they don't know how to build technology, if that in that space, the idea that be able to get their arms around this super complex, you know, technology capability, it's like a nil thing. There's no way they could do it. So we wanted to make it so they could buy and not have to build. Mm-hmm. And So after 10, 12 years of getting it to work, that promise is now a reality. And people say to me, oh my God, how it's so visionary. I'm like, well, so was it when you told people, I'm going to let people buy things with computers. Because mm-hmm. in the beginning, before the internet, you had to explain to them in really simple terms why this was going to be doable. Like, what is this internet? Like, how can they even see? But the world of AI, I can see why people talk about it, because a lot of people missed the internet era. Mm-hmm. Like, think about everybody who, oh, this internet thing, that's for a bunch of kids, it doesn't matter to us, not going to affect our business. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, come on. We can look back and say every industry was touched by the internet and transformed, and now there's entire branches of it, right? And I think people missed that. And I think nowadays the reason why the fever is so high is because, oh my God, I missed the last one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a big opportunity now in the new one, right, to not miss the boat.
Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think of Priceline as a government contractor, although you think, I've heard a lot about the defense travel system, and I'm sure there is a lot of efficiency to be had there. But it sounds like now at R4 you are doing work with the U.S. government, particularly DOD, the national security community. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a cool sort of additional chapter, right? I mean, we're doing great in commercial. Remember the commercial guys. So, you know, retail, insurance, CPG, manufacturing, all that kind of stuff. We do great. Supply chain, logistics, folks from Senate, like Armed Services Senate, you know, they get to know us. They're like, yeah, we don't really understand exactly what you do, but if you're going really well in the commercial, have you ever thought about defense? And of course, you need to stop and like, no, until you mentioned it, it was the last thing on my mind. And I look back at that a couple of years, two and a half, almost 3 years ago now. I'm really grateful that they suggested that. And it's, you guys in defense know, it's not for the faint of heart. It takes a lot of grind and a lot of patience and a lot of, you know, whatever, perseverance. But we're doing some really, really amazing things. I like to think, to sum it up, is we're going to help out-tech the adversary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the end of the day, you learn quickly at the end of it, to provide the life we get, mm-hmm. we got to do it the American way. We got to do it the innovative way. And a lot of times, I think this concept that defense can learn from commercial of things that we do so naturally, they're like, oh my God, can we do that? Yes, 100%. And it's been a really, really cool additional chapter to our story.
So I think, you know, the challenge when you get the new buzzword in the Pentagon or in D.C. is everybody uses the buzzword. And I sense, you know, AI, machine learning, automation all get kind of glommed together. What's your sense on the market? How's that market changed even in 10 years since you started this new company? And how do you see it impacting, I would say, you know, from frontline to back office? You know, because it all kind of gets glommed together and overgeneralized, and then it's really hard to understand truth from myth.
I try to like simplify everything because the world I come from is so complicated and it's easy to get wrapped around. I like to think of this AI thing is, you know, like if you look at all technology evolutions, like this thing before there were data, you know, before there was Oracle, I had to build my own database. Before there was CRM. Like before there was Salesforce, I had to build my own CRM. And, you know, same thing for, you know, ERP, you know, but the government standardized on SAP, right? So there's always this idea that I got to build something before there's a solution I can buy, right? And so, you know, the phases of this is, it follows, there's now no difference as a human society is the evolution of this technology. The first phase is built. So what is everybody running around and doing? They're supposed to try to create software they've had to go through the build process, right? Usually hundreds, thousands of people. It's really complicated. Hard to get it to scale, hard to get it to connect. But it's no different than any of these other phases that we've all watched and said, oh my God, that makes a good sense that I've got to build. Before there was a cookie, we had to build this thing. We built this thing called P-Session. So like, you know, when the website, we'd stick this little thing on because it was, the system couldn't figure out without that, hey, it's the same person. So yeah, you put in New York to LA and then all of a sudden we're treating you like somebody else. So, you know, the technology as it evolves, technology can provide solutions. So first phase of AI is build, right? It's body shops, toolkits, you know, ungodly amounts of people. And, phase two, again, simplifying this, right? The ChatGPT. Like, the thing I love, everybody confuses ChatGPT and, you know, a large language model as AI, right? It's a really important, but really, you know, it's a small portion of what the world of AI is. But what's cool about it, it's the first time that the rest of the planet that's not a data scientist and not in space can say, oh my God, this is doing something sort of like AI, and I didn't need a computer, you know, data science person to do it. And what's nice is the user interface is you can relate. You know, it feels like I can understand it, right? And then, I believe in this third phase, right, which is where we started, right, is decision intelligence, is how do I predict what's going to happen? How do I understand by using, you know, just like we human beings, use an ungodly amount of data automatically to try to then shorten the decision cycle, right? Whether it's, you know, what supply chain items need to be put in a spot so that you're ready for, you know, the bullets, the fuel, the whatever parts and pieces you need to keep a plane flying, or whether it's, you know, the person matching to a role, like what do I need in order to be ahead, like from a talent management point of view? So I believe in this world of AI it's not really the large language version of it. I love LLM. I believe in this idea of decision intelligence. It's all about predictions. It's about figuring out what's going to happen. Because if you could figure out what's going to happen, you could do something today to take advantage of the fact you can see that. It's sort of like in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Mm-hmm. And so that's the version. That's the phase three. I think that's where the trillions of dollar unlock will happen in commercial and in public sector. I think if we are bold enough for a moment to think about how the government like can do more with less. How do I just optimize? How do I, in all aspects, just deliver a better, improved service experience at a lower cost? Mm-hmm. And by the way, R4, that, you know, was named by our head of data science, Igor Zuck, was with me at the beginning of Priceline. It stands for right product, right consumer, right time, right price. But it's R to the fourth, meaning that if I can be right on these dimensions, revenues can go up while costs go down. Mm-hmm. And when you think about that as an analogy, I think it's very American, right? It's the idea I'm gonna innovate. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do something different rather than just try to do the war like our adversaries want, is body shops, because I got more bodies, so I'm gonna win with bodies. Mm-hmm. That's not the American way.
So one of the challenges I see from AI companies trying to operate in the defense and national security spaces, figuring out a way to differentiate, which often looks a lot like what you just did, is going through specific use cases, understanding mission or connecting it to the user community. But adoption of the technology as well, and part of that is teaming with other companies so that you're coming up with a solution or a use case that really resonates. How do you think about teaming on the commercial side, the government side? Maybe you don't have to, but is that part of your strategy?
So, you know, in the world that you need less bodies, yeah, it makes the traditional system integration process less relevant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, that's not usually a popular thought because so much of the business models are people-based, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we believe in this idea of, like, you know, of making one person the power of 1,000, right? Mm-hmm. And so, in the software and the technology we've created in AI, it's much more important to understand the problem and the outcome that we're trying to drive, uh-huh, than it is to have all the bodies kind of, you know, touching data and doing all these kind of, you know, sort of basic things, because the software does all that. Mm-hmm. And in our world, so therefore you're the main person is, or people, is always the one who says, okay, let me describe the problem, mm-hmm, really clearly, like hyper clearly. Mm-hmm. Because let's think of the retail example. When you talk about, oh, I want sales to go up. Oh, that sounds really specific. I want sales to go up. Okay, well, I could put it at 90% off so that I destroy your profits. So you have a lot of sales, but then, you know, I'll make it up on volume, right? Is the old joke, right? Mm-hmm. So clearly sales going up and like promotional, whatever, are counterindicated if your goal is really profit. So clearly being more specific about sales going up clearly is really important. So, but the same thing happens in the defense world, right? Like, okay, what do you actually really mean by this? You know, like, what does readiness mean? Everybody talks about readiness as like on these little one-dimensional aspects. Ready means key in, turn on, fly. It goes. And there's all kinds of other things that have to happen to make that happen. You have to have the part, the piece, the person, all this, everything behind it has to be ready to go. How do you coordinate the lefts and the right hands in order to make that thing, whatever the system is, ready? It's the same thing on the commercial side. So to me, our focus is always on the, you know, it's funny, back to the business user and understanding the problem with great precision, because the problem, when you take a supply chain inside defense, it's complicated. I mean, you got tens of thousands of parts that make one particular system work. I mean, how do you coordinate that? And, you know, I think, so in the new world of AI, I think the new, I know lots of like people like to talk about what kind of algorithm, all this other, what matters now is problem definition. And I think that's the way our, you know, differentiation is this. We can free people up because we can talk about the problem, talk about the outcome, and then how do we, what is being happy? I had a business school professor that every test you got was like, you know, are you happy or are you sad? Hal Bierman, right? And then defend, right? It's like when you get the, so that, but it's a really way, interesting way to think about things, right? So what does it mean to be happy, right? Meaning for this outcome that you're trying to drive, because in the world of AI, it's a lot like a genie in a bottle. You rub on the lamp, and then lots of people say, I want eternal life. Okay, well, they put you under the, you know, in the prison, chained up in the dark thing, you know, for eternity. Okay, clearly I should be more specific, right? So this is where I think, you know, the power of who we are and teaming on the problems and coordination is our advantage. And I think that's what's so cool about the world of AI that we're living in, this phase three, this next gen world that at least we're in, right, of trying to make things better.
Yeah, so Paul, you engage now with a lot of different DoD communities, servicemen and women, and all branches, and all walks of life, all sets, different levels of technical skills. Is there are a couple things that you wish like everybody in the DoD understood about AI as a going in premise? You know, that would help break through some of this, I would say, challenges we've had with adoption. Is there a couple things like they ought to be in the back of their mind when they think about this?
So, you know, I coached Little League forever, right? So I used to tell kids, you got to use your superpowers for good and not evil, right? And so clearly, you know, there's a lot of anxiety when you talk about, hey, I'm going to eliminate all these jobs, I'm going to use it to do all these horrible things. And of course, you know, anything what can be used, you know, for the wrong. So the first rule of thumb is, you know, people with good intentions, right? If we can focus on what the positive, what the outcome is, and then be just smart about it, that goes without saying. That's table stakes. But the other thing I'd say for the average person, rather than get hung up in learning the deep learning, all the stuff you're talking about, rather than get hung up in all that, you know, it's, think of it in terms of like the iPhone. Like all of us have different phones, right? And I can have my settings, I can, you know, change it up, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, green, off, whatever, blah, blah, blah. My apps, your phone, it can be very different than my phone. It may use it for very different things, but it's, go with the mindset that like, it's okay that in the world, I can sort of figure it out for how to, I make this engine work for what I need to do to get my job done. And I, the reason I say it like that is I'm trying to get people to not be scared of it and just make it relatable. And I think the new technologies that are here now, clearly in front of us, they're like, when you see them, you're like, holy guacamole, Batman, this is an unbelievable situation. It just tells me these answers. But the thing with AI, it really is not very good at making a prediction of something it's never seen before. So therefore, the human part, you know, we're really good at like, you know, immediately figuring out, oh my God, this is what I would do in this really bizarre situation. But in the world we come from, that the bizarre situations happen more frequently than not. So my first rule of thumb is try to think of it in business outcomes. Think of it, the world should be like an iPhone, like a simple user interface that I can then instruct and understand, and stop thinking about this AI thing as like some kind of report. Like, that's the other thing too, that happens to us all the time. Like, yeah, I can't tell you how many defense folks are like, show me the reports. I'm like, you know, sir, ma'am, this is about the future. These are predictions. It hasn't happened yet. But this is what we think is going to happen, right? And so the idea of, you know, try to break the frame of reference, I guess is my point. Don't look at using a new school capability and trying to force it into a way that I use old school stuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and I think our expectation has to change. And that's why forward-leaning people who are willing to, like, almost be a little bit kid-like and reimagine, those are the ones who are usually get this really quick. And I think that would be my advice. Don't worry about the technology part. Let others do that. If you pick the right partner and the right technology, that part's going to go fine.
What a corollary to that is, don't worry about creating the 600 billion instance data lake, because I think also there's just, you see these large language models and it's got, you know, a bazillion different parameters and all that. And I sense a lot of folks think that they can't use AI, machine learning, automation until they've accumulated all the knowledge about something for the last 50 years. Is that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this that's a really good question. So data lake things, it's like, it's almost become this excuse as to why this should take $2 billion and why it should take 10 years. And, you know, the reality is that we've entered this era where the data problem basically gets solved. Now, yeah, there are going to be things, laser, you know, precision musicians, it has to be correct, right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the 98% of the other use cases where, you know, human beings will make decisions. We're not landing planes. We're not launching missiles off of the vast majority of this. So the idea that I have to have pristine data is, first of all, there's just too many new data sources every single day. And like we humans, we use a variety of data altogether with only partial data, and we can figure it out. That's the new objective. This concept that you've got to rip everything out is an anachronism of old technology. That is, you no longer need to do that. For the vast majority of use cases. And by the way, the vast majority of use cases are where all the money is. That's where the budget release is. That's where the benefit, the ROI comes from, right? It's I joke about this all the time because everybody in the department always says, oh, we don't have any data. We don't have the data. I'm like, yeah, you have way more data than we have in the commercial world. I mean, we're using signals to try to come up with answers to make decisions. And we have, on a percentage basis, a fraction of what the department has, but because they've been taught it's all got to be trapped and it's all got to be data lake and all the stuff they don't have access to, that makes it feel like they don't have it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another really important question you just brought up, is stop worrying about the data lake part.
Mm-hmm. And I often hear two complaints. One, we don't have the data. Two, we don't have the talent. When you talked about the early days of Priceline, you talked about the team, how culture eats strategy for lunch. I love that saying. But that the team was so strong, and you attributed that to Priceline's success. You've also talked about how AI is changing team dynamics, whether it's company to company or internally too, or some fears around how AI can replace people. Can you talk about how you see as people as integral or not to where we stand in terms of connectivity between the national security community and the defense community? Like, are we okay with talent? Are you seeing on the commercial side interest in supporting the national security community? What's your take on where talent stands?
So first of all, I think we produce some of the most amazing talent. We tend to look in unusual places for talent. So not your typical, you know, AI programs, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when kids coming out of school, or, you know, even grad school, and they show up, I have a, you know, AI degree from a certain, I met my, for the first time ever the other day, I met a kid that comes up and says, oh, I was an e-commerce major. And I'm like, man, I missed the fact there's a major in e-commerce. And I'm like, dude, I was doing e-commerce before there was a major. So the, you know, I feel like the, you know, looking for talent in unusual places, the right mindset of analytics, I feel like there are so many overlooked programs that we pull from, mm-hmm. that are not your typical things. But you have to remember, that comes at this from, we've built software. And so as a result, you don't need to deploy, you don't need the hundreds and, you know, dozens and hundreds of people. And I'll never forget the first time we deployed, you know, we show up with one person, right? And the government has an ungodly number of people in the meeting. You know, it was ungodly. And they're like, where's your team? I'm like, well, we have something that looks like, it feels like 10,000 people in the background when we tell it, when we configure it to do what we need it to do. So I think that comes out, then it gives you this permission to look in places that are unusual. Because remember, going back to our problem, you get folks that come out of school that are really maybe geeky with a particular math, or they took a class and they do one particular branch, but then they don't understand the problems. And in our world, you know, our issue is that our technologists need to be really good at being able to absorb whatever that problem. So we do stuff in food too, all these areas where, like, I have to have someone understand. I can't just be good at the computer part. I have to be good at the life part and understand, because it, when we're trying to make it do something new, that becomes the hard part. So I feel like, and by the way, in defense, I mean, you would know this, Hondo, more than anything, we have ungodly capable people. I mean, it gives you chills when you leave these meetings of, oh my God, you were doing this with paper and pencil and clipboards and spreadsheets. And I'm like, so if we just create this new capability, they can do something in seconds that would take them weeks. And if they were lucky, that's the part which makes me really, really feel good about our defense capability. If we give capability to these people that are incredible in the subject that they are in, they're an unstoppable force. And I feel like that's the big idea. People keep thinking, I got to go hire more data scientists. First of all, they're hard to find, they're hard to get, and they just tend to make it harder for the subject matter people to make progress. Mm-hmm. The defense community produces amazing people, the way it is now, mm-hmm. without any more, you know, new AI stuff, right?
So again, you come from this, you know, very commercial, very tech entrepreneurial. What would you tell your peers or folks coming up with that background about, you know, what are some of your lessons learned engaging in national security, goods, bads? What are you taking away from it? And are there things you're learning through the engagements with national security that actually bleed over to your commercial side? Because I do think there's this sometimes mindset that commercial's got it all right and national defense got it all wrong, and it's a one-way transfer of ideas.
It's definitely not the way at all. Yeah. The thing about being an entrepreneur for so long, my whole career, right, is, I mean, this is a great country. The fact that we create so many new businesses and the spirit of innovation, it's incredible, right? It is also like this enormous curse. Forget about the defense side for a second. It's just being an entrepreneur. It's really, really hard. If you look at society, right, you know, the pioneers are the ones that took the arrows. It's negative selection in evolution, right? Being the innovator is not normally, right? So that's what makes America so interesting, the U.S. so interesting, because we create all these new ideas and this mishmash of things. They spit out, I think I got this other new problem. I think I could solve the problem this way. So just forget about the defense side. Like, it's hard to begin with. And, you know, the only thing I can say is teams, culture, eat strategy for lunch. Teams, teams, teams. You got to have a recipe. It's not just about one person. It is, you got to have the, it's sort of like the joke I learned from my submariner friends, right? Like, how many parts does it take to make a sub, you know, leave? All of them. You know, it takes the whole team, right? Like, and so this is where my advice on that. Now, when you get to the government, it's like you have to kind of make it through the first, you know, phase of entrepreneurship, because the government part, it's complicated. And it's good that it's complicated in many ways, right? But it is, and the government has its stuff to do to lean forward to the entrepreneurs, because otherwise you just keep doing the things the same old way, right? Because it's the only way they can get done. My sense of it is that you have to be pretty battle ready to try to go make it through the government valley of death. I mean, I don't know how else to describe this, but it's, if you think it being an entrepreneur by itself is really tough, trying to do it within the government is a special breed, right? But your point, I think, is even more important, is that when you do get there, or if you do get there, it goes in both directions, right? And I think for so long, we made it seem like what you said, this commercial government, they don't really talk, you know, like they always, even horrible, like things they say, oh, it's good enough for government work, right? It's a horrible thing, right? And it's an idea that somehow the government is just incapable. I don't see that at all. I actually see the opposite. I see insane capability, that the job of technology is to unlock it and deliver that in a really effective way. And I think, maybe this is maybe it's kind of a funny way to think of it, but it's got to be done the American way, right? It's got to be who we are as a from the beginning of time. It's got to be this notion that I take ideas, I give some flexibility to the people in the spot. And unfortunately, the old way where it's all dozens and hundreds and thousands of people, it hardens these silos. So in my mind, the way to unlock this is to try to, you know, put technology in the hands of the actual business people and allow them to lean forward into it at the point of need. But yeah, I think once that happens, I think the government's role in the future of leveraging AI should all be about, you know, just like our adversaries, like, you know, a lot of times in other countries, the business is owned by the government, right? It's like, it's unbelievable how they're in the national security and commercial is actually literally embedded up. They're making a ton of money while actually promoting national security. I feel like we have not begun to scratch the surface on that topic, which is a whole other podcast in this subject. What can we do that actually helps encourage all the economic productivity on the commercial side, but yet advances our ability to deliver for our citizens and improve our security? That is a whole other, you know, but it does not just go in one direction. You are 100% correct. And I think we'd be wise to listen to the plethora of unbelievable capability inside our departments, right?
All right. I have to ask it only because I lived it. Give me the Shatner story. How did Shatner get in Priceline? Yeah. How did that all get conceived? Yeah. If you're willing to share.
Yeah, I can share parts of it, right? We ended up with Shatner because Bill Cosby turned us down. So you just have to pause on that. I chalked that outcome up to the harder I work, the luckier I get. Like, you know, no besmirching Bill Cosby, but I mean, it turned out to be an unbelievable thing. So, but yeah, no, through Jay's friends and whatnot, we networked our way to get to Shatner's late wife, Noreen Shatner. And, you know, at the time, like, you know, it was one of these things. Like, he was fully retired, you know, on his horses, and you know, show up, and he's like, "Will you, you know, we're going to let people buy things with a computer?" Like, which is like, you talk about mind blowing. I'm trying to say, how do you explain this, you know, to a guy like Shatner? And of course, we were just very lucky. Meanwhile, he sent his consigliere to the office, right? And the consigliere, the limousine pulls up and the dog gets handed out. So like, you're like, whatever, when the dog comes out, what do you do? So I pick up the dog. I'm like, oh, so I'm petting the dog. And so like, remember the old flip phones we had, like the old StarTech things, right? So I'm holding the dog and trying to flip the thing and I have to dial because there's no memory. So like, we had this whole like, you know, internet thing. We had this whole presentation, like, radio. This is why the consigliere is gonna hear. And it turned out to be one of Noreen Shatner's, you know, friends, you know, very, supermodel friends and the boyfriend that knew about computers. And so we had, you know, like, so let's just say our original presentation, we didn't do any of that. And with the dog, we kind of walk around, we had to, you know, talk about what we're trying to do and very, very, and that's how they reported back. And so, but the funny thing of it is that, you know, he made a fortune in stock options, right? An absolute fortune. And but we had no money, because remember, back then we were literally entrepreneurs starving for cash. So I think we paid him like, I want to say it's like $300,000, which in the world of like, that is like basically not paying someone like that. And but we gave him these options, which turned out to be worth like, you know, an ungodly tens of millions of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, but trying to convince him, we're going to give you these stock options. They're like, oh, you're trying to rip Bill off and blah, blah, blah. They're like, no. But you know, what was cool about that story though, is, you know, in the heyday of the internet, but also when the, you know, irrational exuberant speech where the world exploded, right? And then, you know, that man was the most committed. Let's do more commercials. What do we have to do to make this work? Culture eats strategy for lunch. And Shatner was, and is, he's an amazing guy still, really, but he was for Priceline. And then, of course, we rebirthed the whole concept of having a celebrity spokesperson, and I think I contributed to relaunching his career, Boston Legal, and all the rest of it. So, but he's an amazing guy. Yeah, he was a great storyteller, you know, and he was incredible. He was just an incredible guy. But that's how we got Shatner.
How cool. I have one more, which is, your energy is pretty contagious, and you've been doing this for a while. How do you stay fresh? How do you keep the good ideas coming? Any tips for folks that are getting burnt out? Or
yeah, it's funny because, you know, I got the kids, right? My kids are older now, right? And you know, they could make it through high school, through college. Nothing is easy, as you guys all know, right? And you got to find your own inner way to refresh. And I was trying to explain, especially on the entrepreneurial side, you know, like, so the scene in Deadpool always comes to me, like, right when he's got the match, he's just listening to Air Supply and he's blowing himself up 100 times because, like, I can't seem to kill myself, right? Like, and so it's an interesting, like, analogy. You got to find the place that allows you to mentally, like in that scene in the movie, mm-hmm. to refresh mentally, because it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And so the, I think that, you know, that's the advice. You got to find something like that. You got to find the people that can help you get point of view and perspective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I do a pretty good job at listening and taking, you know, advice of what can I do to make this actually come forward. But the only way to do it, because otherwise, you know, yeah, it's great to, I could have retired a long time ago, but, you know, it's a lot like it. There's a big opportunity here. And it's mm-hmm. our obligation and our privilege to try to be able to make this better. This is not like an opportunity. I always look at this as with gratitude that we're allowed to do this. But the only way to do that is you got to be able to survive the marathon. You know, these guys that run these 100 miles, I mean, how do you do that? After the first 26 miles, something aren't you like, but it's, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is such helpful advice, Paul. We know how busy you are. Thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your story. I know I found it very encouraging, so we appreciate it.
We appreciate you guys. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Building the Base, a podcast by Lauren Badula and Hondo Gertz. Remember to subscribe and share wherever you're listening. Leave a comment to suggest a guest. And for up-to-date insights on the show, join our newsletter at www.buildingthebase.org. That's www.buildingthebase.org.